This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome. You're listening to New Books in South Asian Studies. I'm your host, Shohini Chatterjee, and I'm a PhD student in Gender, Sexuality, and Women's Studies at Western University. And I'm delighted to be in conversation today with Dr. Radha Kumar on their new book entitled Police Matters, The Everyday State and Caste Politics in South India, 1900 to 1975, published by Cornell University Press in 2021. Dr. Kumar is Assistant Professor of History at Syracuse University. Welcome to the New Books Network, Radha.
Thank you so much for inviting me, Shohini. Lovely to talk to you here today.
Oh, thank you so much for being here. Could you begin by telling us a little bit about your intellectual journey? How did you become a historian and how did your research interests evolve over the years to give shape to this book?
So I grew up in India. I did my bachelor's in history in Chennai, and then I went to Delhi University for my master's long back, about 20 years back. And, you know, subaltern studies was the rage, and I was really deeply influenced by that and continued to be influenced by that when I moved to the US several years later to do my PhD. I think the influence was in this attempt to try and understand, the subaltern. And to me, I identified that at that moment in my career as, the lower caste and lower class communities in rural India. So I think methodologically, it was exciting for me to try and retrieve the history of people who had not written much, or, you know, where there was a need to read, with and against the archival grain to understand what was going on. So to me, that was interesting intellectually as a project. But having said that, you know, when I started the project, I actually defined it not as a history of policing, but as a history of certain caste communities. So to that extent, I'm quite sure I was mimicking the state archives, which can be very seductive. So I was also seeing like a state to perceive certain caste communities as especially involved in the politics of violence. And what I was, I think, failing to see was the role of the policeman, or the extent to which state power itself shapes this sort of caste identity. Partially, of course, it was, advisors nudging me away from that sort of story that made me aware of the need to be a little more critical about my sources. But in addition, there was an archival accident, or, you know, a lucky accident, where apart from looking at the fairly standard archives that historians go to, you know, the British Library in London, the Tamil Nadu archives in Chennai, I had also been trying to find some sort of records that were a little more decentralized. And I had heard here and there from, you know, people in the police that police stations themselves contained records that went back to the colonial era and that would have a lot to say about what I did. And through the first couple of years of my archival research, I, you know, reached out to many people in the police trying to find those kinds of sources, and with no luck, until finally one person who was, you know, part of the senior police cadre in Chennai gave me permission to access police station records in rural Tamil Nadu. And when I went into these stations, I really couldn't believe what I saw, because there were these really textured notes from the 1920s onwards, at least in the stations that I went to, that really spoke about a state, a colonial state, that was very much present in the countryside, that was very much concerned about everyday caste politics, and that was shaping them. And so once I had looked at these archives, I started, you know, looking at what I was seeing even in the centralized archives very differently. And I realized that the story I had to say was one about policing and not one about caste. I mean, or at least policing and caste and not just about caste. And having said that, I feel like I must point out that the archival accident has a lot to do with my position as, you know, belonging to Chennai's upper class, upper caste groups and having the sort of linkages that would allow me to access these records. So anyway, so once I looked at this, I sort of flipped the lens, as it were, to see how the police function in social politics and how policing as a form of power shapes caste politics and is shaped by caste politics. And then that's how I ended up with this book, where I talk about how the two sort of reinforce each other at the everyday as well as exceptional levels.
That's fascinating. Three primarily Tamil-speaking districts of the then Madras Presidency, namely Madurai, Tirunelveli, and Ramanathapuram, serve as the site of your book. Could you tell our audience what prompted you to focus attention on these regions, and how did this choice influence the development of the book?
I think there my personal biography sort of mirrors my professional trajectory, which is that I grew up in Chennai. And when I was growing up in the 80s and 90s in Chennai, the incidents of caste violence, and, you know, it's important to note that these were typically framed as caste violence, not as much as state violence. But both the news media as well as films were very much preoccupied with this question of caste violence in the southern Tamil districts. And there was a sense in which the south, and by south, I mean south of Chennai, these southern districts were framed as the other to Chennai, right? So Chennai was the modern, the literate, the secular, but Madurai, Tirunelveli, and Ramanathapuram were, you know, those regions that could not sort of shake off the shackles of caste politics. And so it was very much the other. And, you know, there were numerous films about these. I think some of them were also remade in Hindi. But so I was curious about this culture, which to me, I guess in some ways was so distant, right? As I started, because here I was, in Chennai, a woman, you know, violent politics is in a sense complete anathema. And so I wanted to study it. But then as I studied it, I realized that to the extent that we acknowledge state power, you know, the politics of Chennai were not that distant from the politics of Madurai, Tirunelveli, and Ramanathapuram. The politics of the urban literate elite are not that different from the politics of, you know, the rural communities that are part of caste, because the two really influence each other. And I'll just give one example here, which is that in one of my chapters, I talk about the FIR. Now, anyone from South Asia is aware of the FIR and the sort of sense of foreboding that the FIR triggers in somebody. Having said that, for many of us, at least until the last 10 years, the FIR was also a very distant thing, right? It was not something that actually affected urban communities, upper caste communities, and so forth, because it was an instrument of police power and police corruption. And to that extent, misuse of the FIR was always framed as something that was distant. It was not part of how we function. Having said that, the reason the FIR acquired the sort of power it did in the early 20th century is the fact that writing is privileged as an instrument of colonial governance, and policing writing was such an important part of understanding colonial reality. And so police power, in fact, stems from how, you know, the state manifests and dissimulates its own power. And so, you know, I would say, in a sense, my project attempts to bridge the gap between these two worlds that are seen as so distant, you know, upper caste, literate, nonviolent civil politics versus rural, lower caste, violent politics are, in fact, in a tight embrace, is what I try and show in the book.
Yeah. You write in the book that the colonial police exercised an everyday presence and brought epistemic as well as legal violence into the Tamil countryside. Could you shed light on the interrelated workings of epistemic and legal violence? And how did they advantage routine policing in colonial South India?
Yes, absolutely. So here, the first thing I want to draw on is a large legal studies scholarship that is emphasizing the extent to which the law itself is underwritten by sovereign power or violence. So, you know, there's a lot of scholarship dealing with things like, you know, the death sentence, torture, and so forth, to show how, you know, law is not, you know, separated from violence, that there is violence in the law itself. So this is quite different from popular discourse that often attributes police violence to bad actors. So our typical reaction very often, whatever, you know, whether it's instances of police violence in the US or in India, often the first point of scrutiny is the individual police officer who is accused of this. But, you know, policing studies will show that it is not a problem of rotten apples. It is the police as an institution that manifests legal violence. But it's not just that the police as an institution are the rotten apple in law. The law itself as an institution manifests violence. So that is one part of what I write, which fits into the scholarship to show that police violence is legal violence and not attributable to individual subaltern bad apples. The second thing which I'm trying to show is that even legal violence reflects or embodies the sort of axes of power that run through society. So it doesn't stand completely independent of that, because policing draws on certain broader discourses about caste inequality, class inequality, gender inequality, or race inequality to choose its objects of coercion. Because, you know, policing is discretionary power. A policeman or policewoman chooses their target before a crime has happened, before due process has happened, and that decision does not happen in a discursive void. It does draw on broader societal norms. And therefore, policing is not just legal violence, it is also epistemic violence. It also targets certain women, certain sort of women. So, for example, policing literature on 19th century UK will talk about how the police selected drunkards or prostitutes to pay extra attention to them. Likewise, I talk about how policing targets certain caste communities, certain class communities to, as the objects of their coercion. And the final point that I want to make here is that the global policing literature very much concentrates on the city. This is partly about, how policing was visible in the 19th century Western world versus in the colonial world. But it's also a question of archival access. You know, what is available is very often writing about cities. But what I am looking at is policing in the countryside. And the reason why policing in the countryside is not really studied much is partly that, colonial police forces were very thin in the countryside. And they don't leave behind that many written records. But what this also means is that their need to see like a state is much higher. That is, they necessarily have to be very selective about whom they can watch on the beat, about whose processions they can monitor, and whom they just have to let be. And therefore, in colonial rural India, the necessity to optimize policing resources was very high, and it drew considerably on caste knowledges. And to that extent, the Madras police in colonial India were agents of epistemic violence because they are sort of reanimating this idea of certain castes as criminal, certain castes as mercantile, and so forth. And sorry, so one last thing that this suggests is also that therefore the colonial state was not a thin presence in the Tamil countryside. They were very much crucial actors in bringing in place a new political economy, a new form of circulation of commodities and policing of labor. So yes.
Mm-hmm. The colonial police, you write, objectified and categorized Indian subjects on the basis of caste, and this objectification and the hierarchy it reified also reflected among their own rank and file. How do you think this composition contributed to caste-based violence and dehumanization of Thevars and Dalits validated by caste?
Absolutely. So here, the scholarship that I am drawing on and contributing to is a recent one, especially in anthropology, but also in history, about the blurred lines between state and society, which is that you cannot understand the state purely by its central institutions, but you also need to think about how the state is present in societal imaginings, in everyday actions, on the margins, and so forth. So in the context of my work, how I'm interpreting this is you cannot see the police institution as distinct from society. And in fact, in many parts of the country, for many communities, the police are a very real, very everyday presence, an everyday state presence. I mean, they're one of the more important state agents with whom people interact. And the police as police are not state agents who are disconnected from their place in a social order. So an upper caste policeman is upper caste and a policeman, right? And to that extent, state power is absolutely in tune with social hierarchies. And so through the 20th century, what you have at different moments is very different composition of the state police that reflects broader trends. And so in colonial India, Thevars were among the caste communities who were criminalized under the Criminal Tribes Act of 1911. I mean, the Criminal Tribes Act was brought to Madras presidency only in 1911. And several Thevar communities were criminalized under this act. So, you know, the the interactions, the everyday as well as exceptional interactions between the police and Devers relies as much on, you know, the police's individual policemen's caste subjectivities as it does on the criminalization of Devers. Now, this changes after 1950 and especially in the 1970s, when the Devers, as a powerful voting bloc, acquire a lot more social prominence and presence. And at this point, Devers are an important presence in the state police. And so at this point, the sort of violent interactions between policemen and Dalits really increases, also as a reaction by the 1980s to Dalit movements and Dalit assertion in Tamil Nadu, as in many other parts of the country. So a couple of final quick points here is that a lot of, human rights scholarship, for instance, attributes the police violence against Dalits in contemporary Tamil Nadu to the fact that there are Devers in the police force. In a sense, the presence of certain communities is seen as tainting the police force. But I do want to emphasize that there is no such thing as a nonviolent police force. There is no such thing as policing that stands independent of social hierarchies. So the fact that the police institution since the 1980s in Tamil Nadu has Devers is more an indication of how policing is seen as an important instrument of power in contemporary society, not that somehow Devers have entered the police force and adulterated it or tainted it. But yeah, maybe I'll stop there.
As one goes through your book, it becomes evident that Orientalism and casteism were very much activated through colonial policing. I was wondering if you could reflect on consequences produced by the dangerous interaction of the two in rural Madras.
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, here I will repeat what several others have said, that tradition is not the static remnant from the past. In 19th and 20th century India, tradition has been actively constituted as the other of the modern, right? So works like Lata Manish show how it is precisely a certain modernizing discourse that creates other practices and other forms of identity as tradition and sort of cements that. And I find that dynamic and operation quite a bit when we look at colonial policing in 20th century Madras, which is that there is this understanding of caste as an immutable essence, right? That, of course, Nadars and Marabars will fight against each other because that is it. There is no changing that. And so there's a very Orientalist framing of how the police or how the colonial state views society. And this Orientalist framing is embodied by native policemen. And in 20th century Madras, in the period I study, there are all policemen. There are no women in the force until much later. And these are native policemen. So the force is a very, very Europeans occupy just the top ranks. And so the bulk of everyday policing is carried out by native subjects who appropriate this Orientalist framing of caste as immutable essence. So it really, caste becomes a very salient, perhaps the most salient identity that animates the politics of public spaces, which is what the police monitor. And so, for example, if a certain family wants to take a procession for a wedding through the street, they have to get permission from the local police. But when you look at records from the 1920s and 30s in rural Tamil Nadu, the police make every one of these decisions through a very Orientalist lens that looks at certain castes as impulsive, irrational, violent actors because of their caste identity. And it does not allow for any nuance in this, which means that the police give permissions to some communities, don't give permission to other communities. They send armed constables to some gatherings, they don't send armed constables to some other gatherings. So just simply through their way of working, through their everyday decisions, whom they watch on the beat, which communities have permission to gather, and so forth, they're really giving new life to caste politics, especially in public spaces.
Right. You also reflect on the neglected figure of the rural constable in the historiography of caste and its silence on routine policing. Could you tell our audience in what ways does your book work towards addressing this gap and the silence?
Thank you. Yes. So law enforcement is actually quite heavy on paperwork, but a lot of this paper is destroyed. Which is to say that, you know, the colonial policeman actually had to write nonstop because the colonial policeman was a very split figure. He had access to legitimate state violence, but he was also seen as a native actor who, with a cultural proclivity to violence. And so to police the colonial policeman, he was told to write a lot. So, you know, every station has somebody called a station writer whose business it is to keep in written record, not just the regular acts of investigation or surveillance, but even what the policeman does when he comes in, when he goes out, because writing is an instrument of policing the policeman. Having said that, just the nature of archives is such that a lot of the policemen's acts on the beat don't have to be captured in writing. And so they are lost to the historical record in some senses. And even many of the records that the colonial policeman maintained in his police station were typically sent to district offices, you know, every quarter or every month or every week, some of them. And once they were sent, most of the records were destroyed. And so what you have typically available as records of policing in colonial Madras are abstracted statistics and annual reports released at the highest levels. And these are the most common records. Now, right. Of the records that the policeman generated every day in the station, there was only one that wasn't destroyed every few weeks or every few months. And these were called the Part 4 records. And they are one of five parts of the station's journal that is maintained. And, you know, so there's one part which records the crimes that are registered in the station, one part that records the, you know, the rowdy sheeters or the bad characters in that station and so forth. So there are five parts. And the fourth part is a running history of the surveillance activities of the precincts, the jurisdiction of that station. Now, the Part 4 records were meant to stay permanently in the police station. And this is a function of the colonial state's distance from the rural population because they were meant to serve as a guide for every new police inspector that would be assigned that station. So the Part 4 records alone survive from whenever, you know, from the 1920s or so. Unless, you know, some stations were moved and so they were destroyed. Some stations didn't care and they were destroyed. But in many stations, the Part 4 records stay. And the Part 4 records are really thick in local detail. So, for example, one inspector writes, and I'm quoting from one of the Part 4 records that I find, you know, Ishwarasamy of Tammanaikanpatti village is a pakka drunkard. His movements should be watched. And this is very characteristic of how the Part 4 records were written. They really show an intimate knowledge of rural India, of individual villages, of their role in the colonial political economy, of their caste demographics. And it was because of accessing these Part 4 records that I got a sense of how law enforcement worked or how the police functioned as agents of state and caste authority. And in many ways, policing is very different from, let's say, legislation or litigation, which produce records that are centralized. So, you know, legislation produce records at central houses in Delhi or Calcutta or Madras. And so there's ways of studying it. Litigation has its own set of records. Law enforcement is much thinner. And so while you have many ethnographies, it is much harder, in a sense, to retrieve an ethnography of the past. And the Part 4 records obviously capture only a slice of it. And that is what I'm trying to retrieve. Finally, what I would say here is that the police constables themselves in Beatriz Joregui's framing are subalterns of the state. So they are not the highest level officials. And so their own position reflects the inequalities within society. You know, there is a lot of provisional authority that is in them, again, to quote her work. And, you know, when you think of the police detective, there's something romantic about this lone crusader who fights against state corruption and societal inequalities. And, you know, the police detective is a very glamorous figure in fiction, you know, in India, abroad, and so forth. But the constable, in some senses, is a mirror of social inequality, and therefore it is a harder figure to shine a light on. But to the extent that we are able to retrieve the voice of the constable, it is an index of, you know, social inequalities themselves. And the particular axis that I focus on is caste.
Right. You write in the first chapter of your book that under colonial rule, the police were also monitoring the rural economy and functioned through surveillance. How do you think caste figure in colonial political economy, and how was caste-based objectification weaved into development in post-colonial India?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there is, of course, scholarship now, for some decades now, that shows that industrialization and the coming of a new capitalist economy did not dissolve caste loyalties and communities. In fact, they strengthened them. And you see this dynamic in Tamil Nadu also, where there were strong overlaps in the rural economy. So laborers were often Dalits belonging to, you know, Pallar or Pariyar communities. Landholders belonged to higher Brahmin or Pillai communities. Traders were often Chettiars or mercantiles. And so since the role of the colonial police was to ensure the smooth functioning of the colonial economy, it was inevitable that the colonial police also monitored certain castes and, you know, use that knowledge, colonial knowledge of caste formations, to train their gaze. Having said that, policing itself strengthened this tie between caste and class because, for example, the police provided protection to Chettiar's strongholds in Ramanathapuram district, which is, you know, an important center for Chettiars, who were a powerful mercantile community. But Chettiars asked for policing protection as Chettiars. You know, they said, we need the police to look out and send extra beats to monitor these maravars who will steal our property. So caste also operates through the language of class interest to ensure its survival in colonial Madras. So, you know, Chettiars were a powerful community even before the 20th century and before they used policing, but their ability to survive as, you know, a community with thriving mercantile interests in some measure owes to the fact that they can tap on policing to protect them. And this sort of overlap or the ties between caste, class, and policing is again very visible when we look at the Nadars, who start off as a more subaltern community, and they Sanskritized in the late 19th century, as has been studied, to become traders, to urbanize, to convert to Christianity, and so forth. But once they, make the shift, they also draw on policing to ensure that their shops, their bazaars get extra protection, that they have certain relationships with the local policemen to ensure that their property interests are protected. So policing in many ways, because it uses the lens of caste, it contributes to this identity between caste and class in rural Tamil Nadu. After independence, the colonial police's imperative or mandate is quite different. It is no longer as much about ensuring the smooth functioning of the economy, but rural India becomes a site of state pedagogy. And in Madras state, this is especially visible because it's one of the few states across India that resolutely held on to the project of prohibition of alcohol. And so prohibition really became the site of contestation and collaboration between state and society, where, there is this continuous presence of discretionary police power in villages towards both, policing illicit brewing of alcohol and consumption and trading, but also, who gets to hold power in rural politics also plays through, this presence of the policing, of the police in rural Tamil Nadu.
You note that acts of routine violence were attempted to be masked by language of law and order, and accompanied custodial violence in both colonial and post-colonial India. How did caste feature in such acts of routine violence, and how do you think it was resisted by those most disempowered by the caste system?
Yeah, that's a great question. So there are many ways in which this plays out, and I'll probably talk about a couple of them here now. So one is conversion. So in the late 19th century and early 20th century, there were many low-caste communities in the southern districts of Madurai and Ramanathapuram and Trinalveli that converted to Christianity or to Islam. And so conversion itself is one form of resistance. But as Susan Bailey and others have said, conversion doesn't mean disavowing the value of rank in society. Conversion was about asserting a higher rank. And so conversion didn't necessarily mean stepping out of caste politics altogether. So you have many communities, Nadars, Pallars, Parayars and so forth, who in different villages, in small groups, convert to Christianity or Islam. But resisting caste hierarchies doesn't stop at that moment of conversion. After that, it is sort of materialized by asserting certain spaces. So, a certain Dalit community that converts to Islam wants to bury its dead in a certain, cremation site once they have converted. Or a Nadar community that has converted wants to be able to take their wedding processions through a different village street. Or, a community that has converted wants to build a church near the village temple. And so conversion is also then followed by these different acts that attempt to plug that caste now higher position in local hierarchies, which are very specialized. So there is a certain village street, there are certain castes that have superior access to that street. Now this matters because the police, in their function as the purveyors of public order, are in a position to put down these attempts to claim public space. And so what we see is this running thread of different caste communities that try and claim space only to be put down by the police. And they don't always get put down, right? So this is a running thread for a few years, they get put down, and then, you know, one community might be powerful enough to actually build its mosque or build its church. But the fact that caste resistance, you know, after conversion is displayed by this claim to public property, public space, means that the police play an important role in, you know, arbitrating it. And often they put down these attempts by saying that this is disturbing order. But of course, order is a maintenance of the status quo. And so that's one sort of dynamic. The other is agrarian conflict, where when low-caste agrarian laborers seek higher wages, higher share of the harvest, land rights, and so forth, this is also seen as disruption of order, both in colonial and post-colonial India. And so, you know, when you have a higher caste police inspector send his constables to make sure that no trouble, within quotes, breaks out during harvest, what that means is suppressing caste resistance and caste movements. And finally, one way of resistance, you know, apart from, you know, this claim to space and so forth, is actually in gossip, in rumor. So custodial violence, unlike these spaces, claims to public space, happens within the closed doors of custody. And custodial violence often targets members of lower castes and classes. But people do resist it, and they resist it by talking about police in a certain way. So that it's a very, you know, the fact that the police can exercise this authority that is backed by the state is very much understood when you read these, you know, documentations of the sort of gossip and rumor that is circulating among subaltern communities in the local tea shop, in the local coffee shop, and so forth.
Yeah, thank you for the very complex and nuanced answer. You write that political parties played a key role in organizing subaltern resistance to the police force. Could you reflect on the nature of such political organizing and the creative strategies that were employed to actively resist police violence?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, here I do have to, I think, spend a minute on the specificity of the Madras context, where caste-based mobilization was quite strong and quite early. And this is especially obvious when E.V.R. Periyar starts the self-respect movement in the early 20th century and establishes the Dravida Karagam. And so there is a very vibrant movement that resists caste hierarchy. And there are two different strands of this movement in colonial Madras. One is the elite non-Brahmin Justice Party that is simply seeking equal representation to the Brahmins, who dominated most of the high-ranked positions in colonial bureaucracies and other professions. So you have the Justice Party that is not questioning the caste system per se, but that wants, you know, an equal position commensurate with the place of upper caste non-Brahmins in Madras. But you also had Periyar's movement, which was a lot more radical and which sort of questioned patriarchy, capitalism, as well as religion in its entirety, as well as the caste system itself. And Periyar's movement was not about improving the position of one particular caste as much as it was about eliminating the caste order itself. And so there are, you know, radical as well as moderate strands to caste assertion in Madras, even under colonial rule. After independence, this is visible, you know, in the strength of caste-based political parties like the DMK, which is quite powerful even by the second general elections in Tamil Nadu, but by 1967, the DMK came to power. And, you know, the Congress is totally not present in Tamil Nadu since then. But what this also means is that there are a multiplicity of political parties that represent specific caste interests. And here the interaction with policing or the ties with policing are quite interesting. On the one hand, lower caste communities are able to articulate their resistance or their critique of police violence far more effectively in the public arena of politics than in courts. I mean, courts routinely sanction police violence as legitimate violence because ultimately all police violence, most police violence is legal violence. But in the political arena, the evidentiary norms are very different and legitimacy becomes as much a question as legality. And so it is possible for, it is easier to articulate resistance against policing or a critique of policing in the public space of politics than it is within courts, judicial courts. And it is easier to do this through the identity of caste because policing is epistemic violence. Policing does target certain groups within society more than others. But judicial courts and judicial norms treat all liberal subjects as equal. The reality, as understood by those who feel the brunt of the police lathi, is that policing targets some communities more than others. And, you know, the recently released Jai Bhim, which, you know, has very rightly been lauded across the country, shows this very, very starkly. And so politics organized around caste make this very apparent. They shed a harsh light on the fact that policing targets some castes over others. So there's the two sort of fed off each other in post-colonial Tamil Nadu, which is that the importance of caste-based politics allowed subaltern communities to articulate their critique of police force, but the continued existence and exercise of police force themselves give an impetus to caste-based organizing because that is a way communities can articulate resistance to policing. And finally, I would say that several communities moved away from the courts to also articulate their resistance in different ways, and statue politics have been quite important here. And again, statue politics have been important in different parts of India, especially, you know, with regard to Ambedkar statues and so forth. And in Tamil Nadu, likewise, the politics between Thevars and Dalits have often played out in a contest for public spaces and public statues. So this is another way in which memories of police violence against certain caste communities are sort of put out there for the public to see and remember.
In the fourth chapter of your book, you note that public assembly in colonial Madras entailed long-term dealings with the police, which influenced caste politics. Would you like to elaborate on this for our listeners and also comment on how this relates to your book and the core concerns that you raise?
Sure, thank you. So one point that I make in this chapter is that while the archival written record highlights the moment of riot when, you know, the police fire on a public gathering or a public gathering maybe throws stones on the policeman, in fact, the interaction between state and society in colonial India was not limited to that moment of riot. And, you know, several historians have looked at, you know, stretching that moment of the riot to look at its prehistory to understand what went into it. And what I look at is the forms of interaction between the police and caste communities to show that the riot is merely one moment in a much longer drawn out interaction between communities and the police. And the two other moments specifically that I want to highlight are the use of preventive policing and the use of punitive policing. So preventive policing, again, something that we are very familiar with in contemporary India, is most obviously seen in the use of Section 144 of the Criminal Procedure Code, which gives a local magistrate the power to preemptively, without due process, prevent a certain gathering, a certain act to take place for a limited duration. So this is the use of emergency powers, but in a very limited setting. But what we find from colonial records is that the police used Section 144 and a similar other provision in the Police Act continuously to keep a pulse on popular politics as well as modulate its tempo. So when they think that there is a certain labor force, let's say in a Madurai textile mill, that is gathering for meetings every day and, you know, they worry that things might get a little out of control. And this is a very Orientalist concern, that if you have a large Orientalist and elitist concern, that if you have a large laboring population together, they would, of course, turn violent. But based on that, they can preemptively stop the people from gathering by imposing Section 144 on that assembly. So the right to curtail public assembly was used in a very calibrated way by the Madras police to modulate both labor and caste politics. And sometimes what happened was that when they imposed Section 144, maybe an issue died away. Often they would reimpose it again and again, keep extending it, so that sometimes in one particular village, for a decade on end, members of one community just cannot gather in public spaces. So they're really reshaping how castes can practice their public politics. But sometimes it ends up sort of pushing the momentum of that particular grievance so that things escalate into a riot. And that riot is what we often see in police records. But the riot doesn't come out of nowhere. And to think that the riot comes out of nowhere is to revert to a very Orientalist understanding of Indian crowds. But even after the riot, the police continue to interact with the participants in riots in multiple ways. So they typically charge all members of a public assembly, whether they were violent or not, in courts. And the numbers of people that are charged and sentenced is staggering. Year after year, village after village, in a small conflict between two caste communities, you will find dozens of people who are charged and, you know, arrested. They also install punitive police forces in these villages where a riot has happened. And what that means is that there is an extra armed police force that is stationed in that particular village for, you know, 6 months, 2 years, 3 years, or so forth. And once again, shapes the possibility or inhibits the possibility of people of that community to come out. So one thing that comes out here is that caste conflict is just not separate from state power. To be able to assert their space or their presence in public spaces, caste communities necessarily relied on the police to either grant them the permission or not. The second thing is that it is not a stark line that separates legal norm from violent exception. So the police in colonial India was supposed to be a civil force that is modeled after the English bobby rather than the Irish armed policemen. And so this is something that they put into effect after a lot of debate. What this meant was that the ordinary constable in Madras was only armed with a lathi, not with firearms. But repeatedly, we find cases of caste communities that have gathered on a street and the policeman fires at them. So how is that happening? It's precisely because how caste knowledge shapes police practice. So when certain caste communities gather in public spaces, the police call for reserve police, for armed police backup, and are there preventively to ensure that no violence happens. When things escalate even more, they call the army. So it's more of a sliding scale between the civil police who are armed with a lathi and armed reserves who are on horseback and carrying firearms. It's not a stark line. And so there are many instances of conflict where rather than just have the lathi wielding constable, you have the armed police or the armed military reserves that have come in. So this is also an argument about exception being normalized in colonial India.
In your book, you talk about policing after 1947, anti-caste activism, police violence, and the lack of judicial redress. Could you talk a little bit about the changing political landscape in independent India, how it influences caste politics and its relationship with policing?
Absolutely. So I guess I would make two points here. The first is that there is considerable continuity in how policing functions after 1947. And I'm not the first person to say that 1947 doesn't bring about a stark divide. There's a lot of colonial continuity. And with regard to policing, this is manifest in, you know, the personnel, the institutional structure continues pretty much unchanged. The legal codes that inform policing are pretty much unchanged. So it's the Indian Penal Code and the Code of Criminal Procedure from the 1860s and the Police Act from the 1860s. All of them continue, the Code of Criminal Procedure from 1898, all of these continue to inform how policing functions after 1947. So to that extent, the violence of the law as manifested in the figure of the policeman continues after 1947 to target certain castes, to use false FIRs against certain people, to torture certain people within cells, to fire on certain communities, and so forth. Having said that, the power of the vote exercises some limit on how much the police are in practice able to use force in politics. So to just give a couple of examples, you know, there are cases of custodial violence and custodial death through the 20th century. In a case of custodial death in colonial India, you know, there is a magisterial inquiry into it typically, but, you know, and sometimes a judicial case, but often the police are acquitted. I mean, by and large, the police are acquitted in these cases. But there is nothing much that the public can do. But even from the 1950s, when there are cases of custodial violence, people do react. It's a very politicized subaltern public who are, in a sense, actively claiming their rights in independent India. So, for example, in 1959, there is a parlor laborer, a Dalit laborer who dies in custody. And immediately the people of the village gather. The victim's nephew directly sends a telegram to the Ministry of Harijan Affairs. The telegram is circulated, between different departments, and an inquiry is immediately launched. So to that extent, it is a very politicized public that is quite vocally challenging police violence. And this happens in many ways. So the DMK's critique of the Congress government in the 1950s and 60s comes a lot from critiquing their use of police force on DMK cadres, which they present as illegitimate. So whether or not police violence is legal, and it continues to be legal in colonial India, it is certainly seen as illegitimate. And that is possible only in a democratic setting. And so to that extent, the power of the vote, which is actively used by subaltern communities, serves as a check on police force in post-colonial India. But finally, there are, of course, limits there, right? So the politics of public spaces are often gendered, which means women have fewer rights to sort of participate in many of these politics. And there is the electoral map of vote blocks. So what this has meant is that certain middle caste communities have a lot of power, But Dalits have still been at the receiving end of police violence, even in independent India. So there are, of course, limits to how democracy works to limit police force. But, you know, there's a but there, I guess.
Yeah. We're almost at the nearing the end of this episode. But before we close, would you like to tell us what you're currently working on?
Oh, yes, absolutely. So after 10 years of working on torture and firings, I really wanted to do something that was, you know, about rainbows and unicorns and butterflies. So I moved to studying about the Kaveri, which has been the subject of conflict. Well, I guess I moved back to popular politics and contestation over the river, but it is a project on the Kaveri dispute between Tamil Nadu and Karnataka over the last 100 years. So starting from about the 1890s, what I am looking at is how colonial subjects as well as post-colonial citizens have claimed water, and in so doing, how they have claimed their, you know, right, their political participation and political voice.
That sounds like a fascinating project. Thank you so much for this absolutely enriching conversation, Radha. I'm so glad we could talk about the book, and I'm so glad it is out into the world. I'm sure it is going to be read by very many people, and and cited heavily, because your book deserves it.
Thank you so much, Shohini. Thank you so much for inviting me once again.
Thank you.